you're right there. You're next to Jeremy, so you should be fine.
Should we back up a little bit for the sightline?
I don't want to be...
And feel like we can include you.
Yes,
is that all right?
Yes, that feels fine. Is that all right? We feel like we're miles away from you guys. So can you still hear us? Excellent. All right. Oh! Should have given yourself notes on that, shouldn't we?
Oh, it's a good thing we've broken the ice, haven't
yeah.
we? In any social situation, always be the first person to say very loudly.
So I'd like to introduce Jeremy Herron to you, everyone, the director of Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies.
I think we've peaked.
We've peaked already.
Yeah.
Last year, you were called Britain's busiest director in the Stage 100.
Mm.
I think this year you've proved that because you've just become new artistic director at Headlong. While bringing these two plays to fruition, you've also said this is the opening season of Headlong, and you've been working over Christmas pretty much non-stop. How's that been this year?
Well, it's been... I mean, it's the sense of achievement in terms of actually getting these things onto the stage. I mean, whatever they're like. I mean, I'm aware as well of these sort of events that you took. Can we just find out who... Oh. Has anybody seen the shows already? Brilliant. Oh, wow. And are the rest of you planning to see them today? Brilliant. Well, I'm aware at these sort of events that you often hear a director or somebody talking away about it without the audience necessarily having seen it, or even without the audience necessarily liking the work. So I'm just going to put that out there to start with. But whatever you think of the productions, I really hope you enjoy them because we've all worked very hard on them, is that it does feel like some sense of achievement having got it from Hillary's magnificent novels onto the stage to make that jump. So it has been an unbelievably busy time, but it's been full of very exciting challenges and wonderful creative opportunities. So there is a sense of satisfaction, although I have missed family Christmas and I have missed a sort of, you know, being able to be present with my kids, literally present, and even when I was there, I was probably 20% of my brain was thinking about a scene change in the middle of Act Two. So I do hope that it's all been worth it.
I wanted to firstly talk about the journey that you've had in terms of bringing this to the stage. I understand from, if anybody hasn't seen this, the plays are now available, and Mike Poulton has written a great sort of opening and explains that he was first approached of 3 years ago to see whether he thought Wolf Hall could be made into a stage play. Could you tell us how... That was 3 years ago, and obviously he's gone on a little journey with Hillary.
Yeah.
When did you first get involved with the project?
I got involved, I think, a year before starting it. So a year last September. So I think I came to it at the end of draft two. So there was a very, very big draft one of both plays that had lots of material in, and then Mike and Hillary between them cut it down to draft two, and then... It went on a journey of sort of being refined between them and various people at the RSC and Greg Doran and myself making contributions and doing readings and hearing it. So it's one of those things that's just been filtered and filtered and filtered and sort of bottled and concentrated until we've got to where we are today. And actually, we're still changing it even yesterday to the very patient and wonderful actors. Their commitment and hard work has been incredible because we've just been pushing since coming up to Stratford in early December and several previews. I think these today are our 11th performances of each play, so that we've just been, it's been relentless. And I think when you're trying to strive for some sort of simplicity, some sort of clarity in terms of the storytelling, you've just got to keep refining and keep refining. And I don't know whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, but I'm certainly relentless in terms of just attention and noting and refining and rehearsing. So it's been brilliant but exhausting.
And what are as a director, in terms of bringing that script off the page, and especially Hillary's most, there's a, you know, Thomas Cromwell's voice being so...
Yeah.
Lead, you know, that's what the voice we hear.
Yeah.
Is that the biggest challenge, or what were the challenges that you felt that you had to really try and... knuckle down to?
Well, I suppose that there's, you know, there's a series of challenges that Hillary and Mike addressed before I got involved, and then I would add my advice from a staging and a sort of presentational point of view. But they'd already made big choices in that There wasn't that sort of interior voice. Although the first draft that I read, there was an occasional monologue here and there. There was an occasional direct address to the audience, but it wasn't quite follow through. In fact, those early drafts seemed to have every sort of convention going on, and the writers had set a lot of dogs running, as it were, to see what would work out. And eventually it was decided between the writers and a few other people that it wouldn't be that close up on Thomas's interior voice, but rather that he would be in the centre of the story. And so that's why the people that know the novels will notice several key differences in that certain characters are introduced earlier, other characters come back in a slightly unconventional and theatrical way in order to provide Thomas with the opportunity to express his inner feelings to people on an intimate level. Because I think on some level, when you're outside the story and you're looking at it, it's about politics and about politicking and about the difference between what your agenda is and how you might want to achieve that agenda. And Thomas is trying to stay alive and survive in a dangerous world. So that shortfall between presentation and what's really going on is always a fantastic dramatic mechanism. And I think we've achieved that by putting him in a variety of different contexts so that you slowly, incrementally reveal character over, in our case, over the course of two epic plays. Mm-hmm. So by the time you get to the end of it, I think it's a complex and detailed sort of psychological portrayal that Ben Miles, who plays Thomas, and those of you that have seen it, I'm sure will agree, it's just an incredibly detailed and controlled performance, and it wouldn't work any other way. And I can't think of anyone that would approach it in the way that Ben's really got his both hands on the role and is really delivering it.
And it's a very intensive role for Ben, because he's not off stage, I would say, over the course of the two plays, maybe twice.
There's a couple of little sneaky pit stops.
Yeah. Where, to get a glass of water or something.
Where we send him backstage and recharge him and then send him back on. But no, essentially it's Cromwell's story, or at least he's witnessing those events that we all think we've got a purchase on, that we all think we know Henry, and we all think we know Anne Boleyn and Catherine and Cardinal Wolsey and the rest of them, Thomas More and so on. But we're seeing them from Thomas's point of view. And there's a wonderful correspondence between Thomas's point of view and Hilary's sort of authorial presence. And those two things are sometimes mixed up in a very pleasing way. So he's not offstage, no, because that's the edit of that period of history, is that it's from Thomas.
And in terms, you talked about Hilary. In terms of, you've worked at the Royal Court and obviously worked with a living writer. You've worked at the Globe.
Yeah.
And worked with, you know, the Shakespearean. This play is very Shakespearean, but you have the advantage of having the novelist with you and the adapter with you.
Yeah.
How does that help you as a director and the cast?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it helps in the sense that there are so many different points of view, so that you've got to... There's lots of plates that are spinning. There's lots of artistic and creative and philosophical agendas. There's a fund of great ideas. It's like a sort of hive mind, this production. And the way that I work, I try and be as inclusive as is practical of everybody's point of view. You know, and that I'll be as likely to accept a strong idea that contributes to actually the sort of mise-en-scène, the actual physical production, from Hilary as I would be from Ben Hastings, as, you know, one of the younger members of the ensemble. And I would hope that I'd be inclusive about that, and that the edit would be the quality of the idea and how it contributes to the story. So it's a brilliant opportunity. There's all sorts of different things to play with. I mean, like this sort of Shakespearean model, you have the sacred texts, which are the novels themselves, and they exist, and they're not moving. And then you have the adaptation, which is a moving thing, which is flexible because it's part of a process. And translating something that is so complete in its form for another form is full of challenges, because there are so many different ways of doing it. So that's just a really fun combination, I suppose, of working. You know, my two favourite things are working with a classic, you know, on a wonderful play like I've been lucky enough to direct Much Ado About Nothing and The Tempest and Uncle Vanya, three of the finest plays ever written, whose texts are sort of sacrosanct and not moving. And I've also had the pleasure of working with writers young and old on their heartfelt sort of artistic imperative and working with them to try and refine their vision and get that on stage. And I suppose this is a combination of those two things. And let's hope it works. But it's certainly been challenging to get my head around it, particularly because of the scale of both plays.
In terms of the play, I mean, they switch locations. And you've been very theatrical, one might say. Well, not theatrical, I don't mean that in a show sort.
Yeah, well, where are we?
Where are we, exactly. But it's they switch places so quickly.
Yeah.
And it's so... And we were talking backstage, it's so easy to be very epic in this space and very intimate in this space. And also you're switching that on a die as well, aren't you?
Yeah. I think that's the opportunity, is that I think an audience... I mean, there's one way of doing these plays where you're very precise and illustrative in terms of the settings. But I don't think that's the point. I think that detail can be distracting. I think what an audience want is they want a mainline to the narrative pulse and the sort of psychological mechanism within those characters and what motivates them and what the dangers and the challenges for those characters are. So, you know, at some point when you've got a massive tapestry that you've got to present to the audience, I think what I felt like we needed to create was we needed to create an environment where every detail had a narrative impulse, you know, that had an importance and had a significance, so that you would almost train an audience or educate an audience into saying, well, this detail is significant, so follow this, and to try and cut back everything that wasn't helpful. And, you know, even yesterday... We had a conversation about with Nick Powell, the sound designer, about some sheep on and a sound atmosphere, and there was a debate about whether the sheep were useful or not useful. And actually, they're not useful. But it was good to hear them for a bit. So the kind of process is one of exploration, experimentation, and then simplification. And often, I always think the kind of as a director, if a play that I work on gets nominated for Best New Play or even wins, I've been lucky enough for some of them to win, or an actor gets a Best Actor award, that's kind of the best thing, because it feels like my work is sort of in the background and invisible, and actually what the audience are really engaging with is the quality of the performance and the profundity or entertainment in the play. So these have been a really wonderful way of doing that. And in terms of theatricality, I wasn't sort of looking for a way to go, look at me, I'm a director, and this is how we're doing it. I was looking away, how do we most efficiently and delightfully deliver these plays to an audience? And it turns into sort of pragmatism, in that you've got to change location. So you ask Ben to turn 90 degrees and change the lights at the same time. And then suddenly an audience is suddenly backed up somewhere else. They've got the energy where they're trying to catch up with the information that you're presenting them, so that you're creating a hunger and a desire in them to understand, which means that you can pull back on overt exposition in the dialogue. You can just give the audience what they need. And so it's almost like one of those tubes that you just try and get all of the air out of it, so that everything is momentum and moving forward. So that's the aspiration. You know, we'll see. You'll see. You can't hear?
Oh, I thought I had one of these on.
It might have a little bit of resonance on it. Well,
do you want me to say all of that again? Okay. I'll try and turn around this way.
In terms of... You've talked about it a little bit there, but in terms of the director's art, director, what they do, you know, part of that must be to do with gathering a cast.
Yeah.
But could you try and share a little bit about your... Is there a way of working that you... you kind of always use going through a play, or does it depend on the play?
I suppose it depends a little bit on the play. I mean, I've settled into a pattern where you start with... the casting is all important. The casting is kind of the main thing. So before rehearsals start, you're working on a few fronts. You're working with the writers on the script. You're working with the design team, the creative team, on how you might physically deliver that story in that space. I'm really lucky to work with, probably an unparalleled, the brilliant creative team, Chris Oram and Paulie Constable and David Plater and Nick Powell and Stephen Warbeck and Sean Williams, just delivering the highest quality work from a creative team that I've ever had. So working with them and then casting. Casting is really crucial and particularly challenging on a adaptation of books that people are very familiar with, because not only are Hillary's characters so vivid, but the history is very particular and there's physical references to these people as well. So there's often a challenge about sort of physical veracity or verisimilitude. And also, there's not the budget to cast everybody individually. And there's not the sense in terms of telling the story to do that either, because what you want is you want to create an ensemble that meets an audience and goes on a journey like the journey that we're going to go today. So by the end of the Saturday evening, for those of you that are going to see it today, we hope what we aspire to is that you've been on that journey and that you really feel part of it. And that's why there's an early choice to present everybody involved in it to the audience right at the top of the show. So there's a sense that here we are, brace yourselves, and off we go. So, you know, the casting is really challenging because, you know, one person might be absolutely spot on for this particular part that everybody's got a physical reference for, but not brilliant for this other one. So, you know, that took a long time to make sure that we were trying to keep every part of the play functioning and served. And I couldn't be happy with the cast. I mean, really, really brilliant, a really fantastic ensemble. And what is particularly pleasing, I mean, Ben is just playing an absolute blinder and is really terrific. And Henry and, you know, Nat and Lydia and Paul Jessen and so on are holding up those famous historical characters really well. But there's something very pleasing about getting extremely skilled actors to do the unlikely thing of doubling. Because, you know, certain actors at a certain level of their career probably wouldn't consider doubling because it feels like a sort of lower status thing or playing two parts. And actually what we've got is we've got these amazingly proficient, virtuosic actors showing off their skills in two contrasting roles. And I think that's another pleasure of the... I would hope that it would be another pleasure in the production that you can see the sort of acting skills are laid in front of you because you're seeing two or three parts delivered in different ways.
And in terms of their journey through rehearsal, how much do you do, that historical grounding with them so that everybody is on the same page? And how much do you go, no, it's the script and that's what we're working off? Or is it
It's a combination of everything. I mean, obviously you need to do enough research so that you don't blunder and make stupid mistakes. But, you know, we have Hillary and Mike around who are... you know their stuff, and Hillary particularly just knows everything about everything, and we'll spot it. She can spot an inauthentic prop at 80 yards, you know. So she's kept us really, really safe. But there is the accuracy, but also there's the confidence in order to perform it. So I always have a part of the process. The early process is always research based, and purely just as a way of allowing the actors to do their own research so that they can fully commit to their performances. And we were really lucky. We had some great help from a guy called David Packer and a couple of his colleagues from Hampton Court. And he came to rehearsal in the early part of our rehearsal process. And he was there and, you know, we had a rule where there was no such thing as a stupid question. So I'm quite good at stupid questions. So I would start that off, just because there's a lot of sort of snobbery and assumption that everybody should know about this period of history. And actually, I didn't know that much about it, which is quite a good position as a director, because you're asking stupid questions, which means that there's no assumptions, which means that hopefully everything is as lived and as thought through as possible. And we had a wonderful, there was a really wonderful day, actually. It was always quite important to me. And the IRC were really brilliant at resourcing it and supporting it. I thought one of the keys to getting into that sort of Tudor headspace would be to consider the River Thames. And so, brilliantly, Zoe Donegan, the producer, organised a boat trip from Westminster down to Hampton Court. And suddenly the rhythm, we understood rhythm differently. We understood travel differently. We understood, and there are still stretches of the Thames that are that don't have banks, that don't have, aren't built, that are wild. And so you just would get a little inkling of what life would be like and what it would be like to be woken in the middle of the night in Austin Friars and to be forced into a boat to go down to Greenwich in order to face, what could be a terrifying conclusion. So that was a really wonderful day, and it was an exciting journey, but it was a kind of bonding, and I find it just it was a very special memory. And then eventually we got to Hampton Court, and we were literally in the same spaces as the characters we were trying to represent.
Well, interestingly, you just gave Nathaniel a note about a timing of something.
Yeah.
And could you just, in terms of...
Because there's nothing on this set, and Ben Miles in particular has been brilliant at being very rigorous about where we are and when we are, because there's no physical representation, but it's really important that the actors have got a clear sense of where and when. And Ben and everybody else has really joined in with that sense that you need to be very rigorous in terms of time and place, even though the audience aren't seeing that, as a way of guarding against a sort of fudging, a sort of theatrical generalisation that happens and it isn't brilliant. So we're trying to ward that off. And I was just having a chat with Nat about the timing of a particular cue, where he moves downstage, and it's all technical, and it's all in a light. And the temptation at this point in the process would be to say, oh, if you want to hit that light at that particular time, then it's this sort of rhythm, and you're thinking about it technically. But actually, the best way that we agreed back there, I wasn't giving him a note, we were having a discussion about it, that we agreed to deliver it, was for him to imagine a corridor that we both walked down in Hampton Court. And I think that hopefully will give him a sense of where he is in the story.
Just picking up on that thought of the idea of the time that travel takes, because that's a fundamental thing within both of these plays, that people are in different places, and what's happening in the time that it takes, is there, can they get there, who's where, where they should be.
Yeah.
I mean, in quite an intimate space, that sense of distance, that sense of breadth of the country, is difficult to achieve, and yet
this is an epic space, I think that's what's really wonderful about this space is you've got these four entrances, you're surrounded on three sides, and there's height. So it's like the wooden O, I suppose, isn't it, of Shakespeare's Globe, in that the audience conspires to create the reality that the actors ask them to. And there's something that sort of implicates you. When you can hear me, certainly implicates you in that conspiracy, which I think makes it a two-way experience. So you can go anywhere. Does that answer the question?
I think so.
Yes.
It was me saying you're very good at what you do.
It was more of a thing.
Can we talk about weather in the play? Because
it's been a while since anyone mentioned the weather. Yeah, sure.
But it's so prevalent in Hillary's books in terms of the effect that the weather has, especially on the king, but definitely on the psyche. And you have there are moments when it does, without wanting to spoil too much, but it does rain on here, and there are moments when you've decided for it not to rain.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts?
Well, a lot of those are sort of practical, theatrical choices about what's achievable. It's all achievable, but what's achievable and what the knock-on effect are. And there's a sort of mini inconsistency with that that's slightly frustrating. But it is about, for practical reasons. I think the thing about I personally think there's something wonderful about everybody moaning about the weather in the 1520s and 30s. that just makes it brilliantly bang up to date.
Yes.
Because we can all identify with that. And there's just something really brilliant about that, because I think on some level, what the weather does and what the sort of the kind of elemental aspects of the production hopefully activate in terms of the audience's imagination is a sense that this is almost like a sort of English, British creation myth somehow. It's like an story. It's like a deep story of who we are as a nation, as a state. I mean, there's all sorts of mischievous, playful, naughty jokes from Hillary and Mike about what we take as granted as... I won't spoil them for you. I'm really tempted to, but I won't. what we take for granted as our sort of modern life, and there's just playful little references to that. So that as well as being in the world of Cromwell and Henry and the rest of them, we're also in our world. And those two, that correspondence is intelligently and playfully acknowledged. And I think it's just a way of, and you know, also the approach to the production is, you know, we've tried to be really authentic in terms of the costuming. The costuming, I think, is absolutely magnificent. I mean, it really is. There's only one theatre company in the world that could deliver that, and they've just really delivered it, and it's been really wonderful to see it. And I'm sure you'll enjoy it if you haven't seen it. So there's an authenticity about that costuming, but everything else around the production. If we had a choice, we would choose a sort of modernist way of making sure that there's a correspondence between that world and our world, so that it just teases that sense that we're all part of some social, political continuum, that this is a very significant chapter. And I think there'd be something really deadly about a production full of fusty, old-fashioned choices, and that's, you know, not necessarily the. So you know, that's the aspiration, is that it's authentic to the period and to tell that story, but there's a contemporary theatrical way of delivering that, and that's the aspiration, and I hope we're successful enough.
Last question from me before we open it up to the audience. So if you have any questions, please shoot your hand up. And we'll try and get through as many as we can. But in terms of this is quite a high-pressure gig, isn't it? In terms of, these are very, very well-known novels that people have taken to their hearts.
Yeah.
It's your first gig at the RSC.
Yeah.
And you've got an audience, you're satisfying an audience that will know the books very, very well, and perhaps an audience that have never encountered the books before. So how's that been?
It's been great. I mean, you know, it's kind of wonderful as a theatre director to be asked to do something like this. It just feels, you know, just feel really blessed and really lucky to be, you know, on whatever that list is, to be on that list, to be asked to do it. And I was such a fan of Wolf Hall. I hadn't read Bring Up the Bodies yet. I had to read it very quickly before I met Hillary. But but actually, it wasn't difficult at all, because it's a total page turner if you haven't read it. So, you know, it was an immediate yes as an offer, just because there's something so brilliant about how sort of meditative and philosophical and just sort of naughty and funny the whole thing is. It's just a really wonderful combination of wisdom and mischief. So the pressure is, you know, I would grab that with both hands, just because of the sort of artistic opportunity for it. So the pressure, I think, is a really positive thing, because it kind of keeps you, I would hope, artistically, it keeps you honest. And what's wonderful about a thing like this is that you can get everybody to come and work with you on it, because everybody else is keen to do it. So that, you know, that's why we've got such a great cast. That's why we've got such a great creative team. Is that people come towards a text like that. So that's that. In terms of what was the second part of your question was about...
It's in terms of that mixture of audience, I guess.
Yes. Well, that, I mean, I think that's the sort of the challenge and the opportunity, is to be able to do both. And I think sort of there's a sort of philosophy in there somewhere, without being too pretentious, about theatre as a form being open and accessible, because there's something real happening in a room in front of another group of people. So there's something undeniable about an authenticity in a theatrical space. And so the gift, I think, and the opportunity of the production is to be able to acknowledge history, to make sure that's all accurate and interesting and detailed, to acknowledge the spirit, if not the exact letter of the novels, but to make it fly in that space at that time. And in rehearsal, it was quite an interesting situation because, of course, we had these two big novels with lots of detail, and we had also access to all the historical record. But I very consciously, I read the novels twice before rehearsal, and then I more or less put them away and just dealt with the texts and the adaptations, and crucially with what I was seeing as a director. So what I tried to do is I tried to trust that Hilary and Mike would represent the novels and the history, but that I could represent an audience, so I could represent somebody that might not know anything about it, and for it to work from a kind of standing start. Mm. And it would be really brilliant, it would be fantastic if we got close to achieving that. And we've got as close as we can, I think.
Yeah.
So.
Excellent. Questions from you, if you have one. Question was about the set, just for archive and for people that didn't hear. So.
Well, if this is, I mean, bizarrely, it's based on, Christopher Oram has designed it, and I suppose it's based on a kind of a modernism, a Japanese architect. I think there's details about him in the, of course I can't remember his name right now, Ando, I think he's called, who did lots of sort of modernist, bold, religious structures that we thought would be a really brilliant theatrical platform to launch the audience's imagination from. Because otherwise, if you're too specific, then you have to stay specific. So how do you, in a space like this, how do you move from Austin Friars to Greenwich to a barge on the river to blah, 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 blah? So what you want is you want a theatrical space that doesn't make itself reductively specific and yet is strong enough to support the spot. And this is a way of bottling, concentrating the story, because it's quite high up there. And there's also certain things that happen with that you might enjoy if you've seen Wolf Hall. But I think what it does is it just puts a little limitation on the space in what I think is quite a beautiful and useful way. And there's something about metal in here that is quite provocative because there's so much wood. So...
Yes, madam, and then lady behind. Yes.
Did you find putting on two plays at once twice as hard as putting on one play at a time, or was there some economy of scale?
That's a really good question. Both, yeah. I mean, hard because you're exhausted and you just think, you know, when will this thing end? This is just a nightmare. It's just far too much of it. And also, exactly, you're exactly right, is that you set the characters up and off they go. And it was brilliant on Thursday. We did the first time, we're doing it again today, but it was the first time that we did both shows in one day. And the correspondence between the two and the payoffs in the second one for things that had been set up in the first one just felt really live and really wonderful. So it's kind of, I suppose if it's good, then it's great. And if it isn't, then it's awful. So it's one of those high-risk things. But in terms of actual practicality of directing it, there's a lot of directing to be done. And there's a lot of different stage shapes that you need to do in order to keep refreshing the audience's eye and their access to the story. So it's quite hard work to keep telling that story. But you know, wonderful influxes of new bits of story, new characters, performers bringing on energy, Ben developing the arc of his story, the other characters developing. You know, so I think it's a great opportunity. You know.
How did you work on them in rehearsal? Did you work fully on...
Sequentially, yeah. I had this sort of fantasy that I've got a really brilliant associate director called Joe Murphy, who's worked with me on a few times, and he's really coming into his own as a brilliant director. So I got him involved thinking, and the RSC got us two rooms. Right. So I thought, OK, well, we can juggle rehearsal, and I give Joe a whole lot of stuff to do whilst I'm working elsewhere. But the big problem was that Ben Miles as Cromwell is never off the stage. Yeah. So that you can't quite do, you could do a few things in other rooms, but you can't, it's all got to go through that twisting and turning story of his. So we just rehearsed it like one very long play. Right. You know. But the story is generally sequential. There's a couple of moments where it slightly goes out of sync for good reason, but basically one thing does, like history, lead to another.
And was that strange to then separate them off that moment when you do a technical of Wolf Hall, get that up on its feet? So you're just running it by itself. Was that quite refreshing? Just to go, we're just going to...
Yeah, I mean, I rehearsed them. You know, we rehearsed them...
That's separate.
Sort of separately, so it was always clear. And then when we got to running in the rehearsal room, the gaps between working on one and then running it and the other was quite large. And then throughout the schedule, those gaps got smaller and smaller and smaller until Thursday, there was 2 hours in between them. And that was... That was where we kind of, the whole process just bottled down to that. Mm. And so now we're there now, where it is one, it is four parts of one play.
Lady there.
Yeah.
And obviously, but what is this really short chart?
Yeah. Not really, because it's just the gaps between the events is in the kind of real world, in the historical world, is shorter, but it's still a gap. So you do cut from one scene to another. In Wolf Hall, you cut from one scene to another, and actually it's been 7 years. But you don't need to rub the audience's nose in that, because that'll just, you know, the cold hand of logic could just ruin everybody's fun. But you want the kind of emotional logic of one thing leading to another. And in Bodies, it could be minutes. But actually, the rhythm of the play feels, it feels like it's just getting bottled down to a kind of a singular event at the end. And of course, what we've all started doing, what I've started doing since Thursday anyway, is craving the third play.
Yes.
if only she'd get on with it.
We think she'd been doing something else.
I don't know, she's just been hanging around writing scenes. She should be writing that third book. So, no, we're all desperate to see what happens with that. I'm sure you all are as well.
Excellent. We're going to rattle through a couple more questions because we've got a dance rehearsal, fight rehearsal at 12. So,
I hope you brought your leotards.
You're already ready. All for you. Lady at the front, thank you.
The earlier question about it becoming one story, the two plays.
Yes. I feel both. I mean, it's that thing. It's like I feel like Cardinal Wolsey. I feel like a divided man. I feel like I've got to deliver two plays that build to something on a day like today, but also if somebody only comes to one, that there's a satisfying conclusion. And I think we've got as close to that as possible. We've really tried just to... I mean, it's in the writing, and the writers have sort of delivered those halves of those stories that are... I think are satisfying enough. There's enough of a sort of an emotional... It's an incredible achievement, it has to be acknowledged. But there's enough of an emotional landing strip at the end of Wolf Hall that I think is satisfying, and certainly in terms of the audiences that we've had, they've felt that a cycle has come to an end and they spontaneously wanted to applaud it, which is a good sign. And yet, it is a bit of a cliffhanger. Mm. And I heard somebody last night say... straight after the curtain call said, I'm definitely going to book for the second one now.
You'd be lucky.
Well, yeah. But that was really wonderful. You know, it was really wonderful that there was a sort of element of a cliffhanger, you know.
Cool. Lady at the back, yes.
Yeah, great. They are good. It's Sian Williams, who's a really wonderful choreographer who I've worked with at the Globe, and she is just absolutely amazing, particularly getting very reluctant middle-aged blokes to commit to authentically period dances that tell just wonderful stories, you know.
Oh, the story, yeah. You know, the eyes and
things. Yeah.
And all of that is so loud in dances.
Yeah. And that's... You know, well, this is a wonderful space to work in because it's not like there's a single playing where you can normally tell an audience, look at that, look at that, look at that, that you're dealing in this space three-dimensionally, which, you know, the benefits of that are really terrific, but the challenges are huge as well. And Sean has done a really fantastic job on that, yeah.
I was going to say, another conversation backstage with Nat Parker going, I actually get a close-up in this play, which he never thought, which is the space and the direction,
yeah.
Surely.
Well, you just move him down here.
You just move him down. But it is. It's nice that an actor feels
yeah.
that in this space.
I hope he isn't listening.
We are going to have to draw this to a close because I can hear a stage manager getting angry with me because we've got 2 minutes before a dance rehearsal will start in this space. Thank you very much, Jeremy, for sharing our thoughts.
Thank you. Thank you
for coming.